All right, everybody, this is Jace from The Comic Source. This episode is the interview I did with Kurt Busiek at Phoenix Comic Con. It's the longest interview I did. Kurt was very generous with his time, so I want to thank him for that. There's a lot of great information, whether you're a Kurt Busiek fan or not. There's a ton of information in this interview about how he comes up with his ideas, what he thinks about the future of the industry, what he thinks about doing long runs on books, just all kinds of great stuff. So again, I really want to thank Kurt for his time. Also keep in mind that we did this interview at his table in Artist Alley, so I think I edited out all the interruptions. If not, I apologize for that. You know, people are coming up to his table to talk to him, and I certainly don't want to make a fan wait. I'd rather wait while Kurt signs books and talks with the fans. So again, I appreciate your support, everyone. Be sure you're following The Comic Source on our website, thecomicsourceblog.com, as well as on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for us on Facebook. We're also on Instagram. Any following we get on social media really helps out. So thanks a lot, and stay tuned later this week for a lot more creator interviews from Phoenix Comic Con. Thanks a lot, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
What kind of nonsense do you want to talk about?
All right, this is Jace from The Comic Source. I'm here with comic writer Kurt Busiek. Kurt, I wonder if you could tell our listeners, for those that aren't familiar with your work, what are you currently working on? What do you have coming out on a monthly basis?
What I've got currently coming out on a monthly basis is Astro City from Vertigo. It's a series, creator-owned series that I've been writing for a little over 20 years now. And it's stories of what it's like to live in a world of superheroes, supervillains, monsters, mad scientists, all that kind of stuff. We tell stories from the point of view of ordinary people, the heroes themselves, alien spies,
So it's nonfiction.
Pretty much. And on a not quite monthly basis, I'm doing a series for through Image called Autumnlands, which is another creator-owned book I'm doing with Benjamin Dewey. We've just recently started up. I think number 10 is the latest issue out. And this is a big, epic, high fantasy series about animal people and what happens when they, in an effort to save their world, cast a huge magic spell to pull out of time the ancient champion of legend who brought magic into the world in the first place, and they get a human soldier. So along the way of trying to save the world, they're going to learn a lot about why their world exists the way it does, and what's really going on, and saving it is going to be a lot more complicated than they'd imagined.
Yeah, no, I've only read the first two issues of Autumnlands, but I loved it, and I felt like it was almost a story about the old cliche, be careful what you wish for, because life turns out to be much more complicated than you expect. Well, so what are some of the themes that you're trying to explore in Autumnlands?
Well, at least early on, one of the big themes was who's the real animal here? Because we have a civilization of animal people who, through magic, bring into their midst a human who is more brutal than any of them. So his methods for dealing with problems are very, very, very pragmatic, very, very kind of military. You'd look at them and you'd think that the soldier from a more technological age is the more civilized, but who really is? And beyond that, I don't want to give away too much about what's coming, but there are themes of control and independence and destiny versus freedom, and there's a lot of stuff going on. But be careful what you wish for is always a good thing to keep in mind, because everything is always more, a little muddier, a little, less clear around the edges than any sort of legend or religion or political belief would have it. We like to think about purity, but the world is is in essence muddy.
Right. Now, when you come up with the idea for the story, is it the story that you want to tell, or and the themes develop after that, the bigger ideas, or do they come at the same time, or how does that?
Well, I'm not a real big believer in theme as we learn about it in school, because it's very confusing and contradictory, and we're told that the theme is the message, but it's not message. Theme is important, but on the other hand, if you want to write a story, you know, you can write a great story about a theme like war is hell or love conquers all, and those are cliches. So, is it really, I read a book years ago that changed my life as a writer, a book called The Fiction Editor by Thomas McCormick, and he argued that theme, as it's taught on college campuses and in high schools, is wrong and confusing and destructive. And what it really is stories need an organizing principle. The writer needs to have something in mind, and it almost doesn't matter what it is, because the purpose of theme isn't to communicate to you in 300 pages what you could say in one sentence. The purpose of what, for lack of a better term, could be called intent, is to have a principle around which the story is built, so that you can say, does this character serve the intent? Does this scene serve the intent? Have we gotten too far away from the intent here? If we have, the story's not working. Get back on track. So your theme, your intent, I'm on a video interview and I'm making air quotes, could be as simple as, I want to make the reader feel like I did when I was 17 on Martha's Vineyard, having, you know, the first independent summer of my life. This is not any sort of a weighty message, but if that is the intent, you can organize the story. You can say, does this scene serve what we're doing? Does this character serve what we're doing? If not, get it out of there. Reading that book really turned me around as a writer, because before then I kind of felt like a fraud, because I was basically writing stories from plot and figuring, you know, there's all this bigger stuff out there and I don't know what it is, so I'm a fake, and eventually they'll figure that out and they'll kick me out of the industry. And reading that, I was able to say, well, no, I understand that. I can work with that. And all of a sudden, my writing started to get better because I knew more about what I was doing, because I was organizing my stories, even though I may not have had some big weighty theme to tell. When I'm writing a story, often what comes first is the characters and the situation. And then I have to mess around with it until I figure out what is the story about. And sometimes then, you know, that leads me to the ending. Or if I know what the ending is, that helps me figure out the intent. What Neil Gaiman sometimes refers to as not what the story is about, but what the story is about.
Right.
And so, you know, it doesn't come in any particular order. Usually I have a snippet, a character, a situation, and the rest of the stuff kind of accretes around it until I've got something there that I know what to do with.
So. Right, so it almost sounds like you're saying the theme comes about organic, like get an idea to tell a good story, and then if it's a good story, a good idea, your themes and the message you're trying to get across are going to build organically, much like the characters themselves grow.
I think so. That once you've worked out enough of the story, you can then look at it and say, what's it about? You know, what is this story shaping itself up to be about? And once you know that, then you can fine tune it and add things and cut things and basically cohere it around your intent. But figuring out I don't think anybody decides I'm going to write a story today about the intransigence of people in the face of their own well-being. You start a story, you start playing with stuff, and you go, oh, this reminds me of that guy who wanted to do something self-destructive, even though he knew it was self-destructive, because he wanted to do his idea instead of somebody else's idea. And then you say, okay, well, maybe that's what the story's about. And, oh, yeah, I could use this character to do that, and this and there. And it starts fitting together. But I don't think that's usually, I think you start with some sort of story kernel, whether it be a character or a situation or whatever. As things are shaping up, you can dig out or recognize a theme that helps you focus things better as you go.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit specifically about Astro City,
okay.
A book you mentioned that you've been working on for 20 years. You've taken some breaks. There's been some periods where the book hasn't been on the racks, but you keep coming back to it.
Uh-huh.
What is it about Astro City? Is it that there just are so many little kernels that you have in that world?
There are. I mean, the secret of coming back to Astro City is that I never left. Every time that there's been a hiatus in Astro City, it isn't because Brent and I stopped working on it. It's because I got sick, and what happened then was we slowed down. So the whole period between the last Wildstorm issue and the first Vertigo issue, we were off the stands for a number of years. I was writing scripts as fast as I could, and Brent was drawing them, and we were, putting them in the drawer for when we would be ready, when my production would have gone up to the point where we could bring the series back. So, the first issue that was written in that bunch of stories was probably, maybe the fourth issue in the series. But we kept doing books and putting them in the drawer and doing books and putting them in the drawer until we had enough to say, I'm now writing fast enough that we could bring the series back. And we had, most of the first year's worth done. So from our point of view, we've never stopped. From the fans' point of view, the book comes and goes. But from our end, it slows down and speeds up, slows down and speeds up. I expect the time will come when we feel like we've done enough and we've brought it to a close. In the meantime, we're still going because we've still got stuff to say. We've got characters to explore. We've got story ideas we want to get to.
20 years, especially in today's marketplace, though, I mean, that's very admirable that you still have ideas in that universe.
I don't know. I think that there would be a lot of people who would be perfectly fine doing 20 years or more of their book, but the market isn't supportive. Now, the thing that I've been surprised by is that we've had the audience so that we can keep going and we can keep putting books out, and the sales are there, and the readership is supporting the book. If you're doing you know, Avengers or X-Men or something, then particularly these days, in 20 years, somewhere along the way, someone is going to have decided, we need to be going in a different direction with this series, and you'd better be agile enough to shift over to something else, because somebody else is writing that book, even if you would have been happy to write Fantastic Four for 20 years. And in the, you know, in the creator-owned field, I think that the number of books that last that long is low, in part because the sales aren't there. So I've been very, very grateful to the audience that they're there to support what we want to do.
And you books, do you have a limit?
Nope. So, I mean, I think in terms of long stretches that I've been thinking about, you know, it would be nice to write some prose, to write some novels. And I get the idea that if I wrote novels, they'd be long novels. Because when I think about where does this story go, what's the conclusion? The conclusion tends to be a fairly long way off. Astro City isn't a series that has a natural conclusion anyway, because it's you know, it's a universe, it's a world. But you know, there are some writers who think in terms of, well, I want to do these six issues. I want to do this six-issue story, and I'm done. You know, I could do a year and a half, and I'm done. And I don't seem ever to be able to do that. Now, if you ask me to do six issues of something, I'll think about it. By the time I've got enough for six issues, I've got enough for 30. Because I think on a large canvas, I want to get into why the world works the way it does, and explore a lot of angles of it. So in my case, my natural inclination is to have room to explore. And like I said, we've had the support of the audience. I mean, another obvious example that I'd bring up is Hellboy. Hellboy is as far as Mike Mignola is concerned, you know, Mike is ending his his most focused, you know, where he writes it himself and you know, where draws it or works closely with an artist. They're still going to be continuing the stuff that Mike Coplatz and somebody else writes, but Mike is kind of done with Hellboy, and he started Hellboy a year before we started Astro City. So he's had all this time, and he's had the audience support, and he's been able to do what he wants, and he's come to a conclusion, and who knows, maybe 4 years from now he'll be like, let's get back into Hellboy. But you know, it's nice when that support is out there.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for coming.
I am happy to be here.
Thank you.
Look how happy I am.
It's interesting to listen to you and Mike about Hellboy. Everybody wants more, but sometimes other people want to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've certainly got a big stack of Hellboy.
Yes. Good stuff, though.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Have you? You said the audience has been there for Astro City. Have you had the experience where the next generation has come up with the previous generation, like parents introducing their kids to the story? Have you been fortunate enough to have that experience at a convention?
I want to say no. But that might be simply because I've forgotten some sort of encounter. I have run into readers who, you know, who are younger than the series. It's hard for me to imagine, hey, I've got a reader here who, as far as he's concerned, Astro City has existed his entire life.
Yeah, that's cool.
Because to my mind, we're still getting established here.
And you said you like to work big. I think that's one of the things I enjoy about your writing. I mean, I'm happy to read somebody who does a 6-issue story and have this one story to tell, but I'm the kind of reader that I want, when I'm introduced to a world like that, I have so many questions about other things, you know. If the story's interesting enough for me to read the 6 issues, I want to know, okay, well, what's it like to grow up in that world? You know, what are the politics like in that world? What's the economy like, you know? So I'm happy to hear you say that. It's more about world building than just story building.
Yeah, well, I like world building a lot. I mean, lots of different writers have different approaches. It seems like, Ed Brubaker, he's got things like Criminal, where it's basically short crime novels that take place all in the same world, so he's got a cast that moves around to in between the series. But when he does something like Fatale or The Fade Out, you know, he's got a story in mind, and he gives the story enough room to be told. So if it takes 18 issues, 24 issues, 12 issues, whatever, he's giving you enough, but he's reached a conclusion. Me, I tend to think of things that you'd need 30 to 50 issues to reach that conclusion, and he is thinking in structures that are tighter, but they're still not your 8 issues and out or 4 issues and out that we see in a lot of mainstream comics. So, you know, I don't know how long a book like Saga will run, but that's clearly a big, sprawling, let's explore the universe as we explore this relationship series. And it's very enjoyable to watch it go. I like the fact that the comics industry now allows things of that shape to exist. You know, it used to be ongoing or nothing.
Right. Well, talking about exploring ideas, you've worked on some pretty big icons in your day. Spider-Man, Superman. You still have some ideas for those big icons, or do you more of want to focus on the creator-owned side of things these days? And
the answer to both halves of that is yes. If I was writing Spider-Man, I know what I'd do. If I was writing Superman again, I know what I'd do. I sometimes itch to write, that 36-issue run on Legion of Superheroes and build what I want to see out of the stuff that people have done, or Wonder Woman, you know. But I'm 55 years old. I am more aware than when I was 25 that I do not have time to do all the things I want to do. So I have to prioritize. And given the choice between doing Autumnlands or doing Wonder Woman, you know, maybe I could do a really cool run of Wonder Woman, and then a couple of years after I've stopped, there'll still be Wonder Woman and somebody else will be doing it, and they'll have thrown out all of my ideas because they like their ideas, and it'll sort of get plowed under with the rest of the back continuity, particularly when DC has a habit of blowing up their universe throwing out a lot of individual stories. But Autumnlands will still be Autumnlands. Autumnlands will be what it is, and nobody will come along and mess with it. And the people who decide whether it stays in print will be the creators and the audience. It won't be a company who says, well, you know, we're pushing a different kind of Batman this year, so this other Batman stuff, we're going to let those books go out of print and keep in focus the kind of publishing program that pushes the vision that we favor at the moment. One of the reasons I'm doing more creator-owned material now than I used to was I did Superman Secret Identity for DC. They did a trade paperback. They let it go out of print, and it was out of print for years and years. It's back in print now, but for a long time it was... I don't think I've done a bad project with Stuart Immonen, but we did, an Avengers story And that Avengers story is, we did a couple of issues, and that's in print because my whole Avengers run is in print. We did Superstar and Shock Rockets, and those are in print because if a publisher lets them go out of print, I take the rights back and take them to another publisher and get them back into print. And we did Superman Secret Identity, which is the best of the bunch, and it was unavailable because DC didn't have an interest. And like I said, it's now available again, but it's not under the control of me, of Stuart, of the audience. It's under the control of DC, and they may have other priorities that year. I don't want to do projects where if somebody, you know, if the person sitting in the publishing chair has a different idea that year, my stuff isn't out there, it can't reach an audience, it can't help support my family and me continuing to do the kind of thing that I want to do. So I want to focus more on the stuff I can be in control of, the stuff that I build from the ground up.
Well, you write stories to be read. You want them to be read, and if I can't go out and buy it, how am I going to read it?
Right, and when I was a kid, you know, it was like 1971, 1972, I'd stop by the bookstore after school, and I'd pick up another Robert Heinlein novel. And I didn't know that these books were written before I was born. I mean, by the time I was 12, 13, I knew. But they were just available because the guy wrote them. They're good. People want to read them. So here we are. But as a comic book reader, if I wanted to read Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's Fantastic Four, I had to go buy the original issues. Nowadays, you've got the books, you've got the collections, and I like that comics have moved in that direction, but the next step is, you know, if Heinlein's books go out of print at one publisher, the estate's agent will find another publisher and make them available again. And that will go on as long as there's an audience there to support the material. But if you've got, you know, I've been very lucky that my run of Avengers continues to be available to readers. Flip side of that is that I did a year on the Defenders with Eric Larson. That's never been collected in book form at all. Is there an audience out there for it? Clearly Marvel doesn't think so. I bet there is. I don't know, you know, it's not as big as the audience for the Avengers, but I think that would be a book that would get some support, that would have readers going, I'm so happy to have this in you know, on my bookshelf. But it's not up to Eric, it's not up to me, it's not up to the audience, it's up to the people at Marvel who might even agree with me. Yeah, there's an audience for that, it's just that we have other things that there's a bigger audience for. So we're putting our resources into those. And I can't do anything about that.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about...
Cheese?
Swiss cheese. No, let's talk a little bit about looking back, not to get too morose here, but like you said, you're probably closer to the end than you are to the beginning. So looking back over the body of your work, is there one book or one idea or one property that you can look back and you think, you know what, that was the most rewarding for me. I feel like that was me at my peak. It turned out exactly or even better than I anticipated.
Well, those are a bunch of different questions, but it's rare that something turns out exactly as I anticipated, and it's cool when it does, but the two artists I worked with who have come closest to what was in my head when I was writing the story. I did a two-part Avengers story with Steve Epting, and despite the fact that I worked on the book for years with George Perez, when I'm plotting an Avengers story, what's happening in my brain is John Buscema.
Okay.
Because the Roy Thomas, John Buscema, Tom Palmer run of Avengers, to my mind, that's what Avengers looks like. George's Avengers is a separate thing. It's cool. It's dynamic. It's exciting. But Buscema and Palmer on Avengers is simply where my brain goes as a baseline. So I was imagining pages looking like that when I plotted the story for Steve to draw, and Steve drew what was in my head but better. But the body language, the character attitudes, the this is the big splashy panel on the page, all this stuff, he was, you know, he wouldn't have been able to have it more closely fulfill my imagination if he had telepathy. You know, if he could have read my mind and said, oh, this is what he's looking for. Oh, here's how I kicked that up a notch. He just did it naturally, and that's how it came out. And I did a story with my pal James Fry, an 8-page Iron Man story, where literally every panel of that book, every panel of that story is, you know, from the angle I imagined it. You know, the characters, the right size and the right relationship. Those were such easy books to dialogue, because what was on the page was so close to what was in my head. But that's not the same thing as good. I mean, in both of those cases, I think the result was excellent. But Superman's Secret Identity, to pick an example, Stewart did it his way. And his way was often very different from what I imagined when I wrote the pages. But what he did works really well. And what I had to do once I saw the pages was, well, I'm going to cut this dialogue because it's not necessary anymore, or I'm going to change it. Basically, I had to rewrite the script so that it would match up to this awesome artwork. He'd found so much humanity in the story beyond what I'd even written in that I had to say, okay, you know, I served you the tennis ball. You served it back to me with an interesting spin. Now I've got to do this for the game to continue well. So I had to up my game to equal his game, and the result was a book that is better than my imagination. We did with Dave Wenzel. I can sign as I.
I didn't want to interrupt your conversation.
Yeah,
not at all.
Certainly. With Dave Wenzel, I did a book called The Wizard's Tale, and we had a vision of what that book should be when we originally did it. The current edition of it that's out from IDW is everything we wanted it to be and then some, because that kind of book was not published in the comics industry. Thanks for coming by. That kind of book wasn't published in the comics industry at the time that we did the book. So now that it's possible to do a book that way, the book is cooler than even our coolest dreams for it. Projects that I've done that I think are... I mean, certainly Astro City is a fairly large body of work that has been miraculous for me. And, you know, that grew out of Marvels, which, you know, worked very well. Superman's Secret Identity is one of the best things I've written.
Very nice.
But, you know, there's the comics is inherently collaborative. So what I imagined when I go into a project and what comes out the other end doesn't necessarily, you know, what comes out the other end may have been transformed quite a bit from what my imagination going in was, but it may have improved. So I'm not all that worried about it. You know, it's nice when it matches my imagination, but it's nicer when it improves on it. Does that make sense? Did I lose something in there?
No, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense.
I ask him, does that make sense? And his answer is no.
All right, one last question.
Okay.
This is to get a little philosophical.
Philosophical?
Where do you see the future of comics, both as an art form and as an industry, now that it's invaded pop culture, being that you have a perspective of being in the industry for so long?
Oh, these are bad questions. I never know. I can tell you what I like. You know, I like the wider and wider availability. You know, I don't read many comics in digital form, but I'm glad they exist because it's a way for people to get comics even if they don't have a local comic book store. I like, you know, book editions. I'm a book guy, and I love that this stuff is, you know, we're preserving our history. We're making it easier for people to get the classic stuff. I mean, when I was 17 years old, the summer between high school and college, every weekend I was down at the Boston Public Library going through microfilm copies of the Boston Herald and reading Steve Canyon's Terry and the Pirates from the beginning.
Wow.
All through Steve Canyon up till about 1960. Because if you wanted to read that stuff, that was where you could get it. Today, if I want Milken if Terry and the Pirates, there's a 5-volume set out from IDW, and you know, if you're willing to drop $60 a book, you know, boom, $300, and you've got this, you know, 14 or whatever it is year run of some of the world's best comics. And Steve Canyon, there have been numerous reprintings over the years. None of them have quite gotten up to the point at which I read through in the library before I had to go off to college. I think one more of the IDW volumes and then we'll have hit that point. And then then for the first time in something like 40 years, I will be able to read new Steve Canyon because we'll have gotten to the point where I've never read it before. But it's just so much easier. It's so much more convenient to have this stuff. So I, you know, in terms of the industry, I think we're seeing kind of a bifurcation of the industry as the big publisher-controlled universes are focusing more and more on the core appeal of we want the characters to feel like the movies, we want the characters to have the crossovers and the events that we're selling the universe experience. And at the same time as that's going on, we're seeing an explosion of creator-controlled material, particularly through Image, where you're getting more and more books that are what their creators want them to be, that are more like what you'd get in an author who writes novels. I'm going to write this series for a while, then I'm going to write, you know, these two books, then I may come back to this series. And Ed Brubaker is a TV and movie focused guy, but if you look at what he's done with Sean Phillips, it's much more the profile of a working crime novelist than it is of a traditional comic book writer. So I think, you know, I think we're going to see, at least for a while, the big universe is concentrating on we're giving you this semi-interchangeable big universe appeal, where if we lose one guy from Captain America, that's all right. We'll get another guy for Captain America, and he'll be delivering you, hopefully interesting Captain America thrills. But it'll all be a component in the big machine.
Right.
But at the same time, we'll be getting a lot of creative independence in other places. I think that, you know, formats are changing. I kind of point to sometimes the way science fiction and fantasy used to be a short story form. Mm-hmm. That if you wanted to read that material, you got Analog and Astounding and Weird Tales and things like that, Unknown. And they started collecting novels in book form, and then people started writing original novels that got serialized in the pulp magazines but were intended for and had their longer life in book form. And then we got books that didn't appear in the magazines at all, and now the magazines are kind of, you know, there are a few that still exist. But if you're a short story writer in the science fiction community, you are far more likely to be publishing online than you are to be publishing on paper. Mm-hmm. But science fiction and fantasy prose is a novel-based industry, and it went through this shift where it was halfway in between and blah blah blah. And I think something like that might happen with comics, where if we get to the point where publishing an original novel, you know, a 300-400 page book in comics form makes financial sense, and to some creators it already does. I mean, you look at what Kazu Kibyoshi, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, is doing with Amulet. Those are book-length, you know, books. He's doing a series of fantasy novels that are being published by the graphics imprint of Scholastic. But, you know, here's this year's new Amulet volume, much like, you know, here's the new Terry Pratchett novel. So that's working for him. And there are other people working that way, but that may become a larger part of the industry, and the serialization may become a smaller part of the industry. If so, it'll happen faster with the creator-owned stuff than it will with the company-owned stuff. I don't want to predict that it will. I just want to say that would be an interesting way to go. That would be something that I wouldn't be dismissive of. But what will happen, your guess is as good as mine.
All right, fair enough. Okay. Well, Kurt, if our listeners want to follow along with your work, what's the best way to keep up to date with Autumn Lands and Astro City?
Buy them.
Well, obviously buy them, but how do we know when the new issues are coming out?
Well,
where are you available on social media?
I am probably most active on Twitter, where I am at Kurt Busick. I have a Facebook page. I actually have two, but the one that matters is, it's called the Official Kurt Busick Page. And that's where I do most of my Facebooking. But every time I get a new, you know, here's the new Astro City that the publisher has sent me a week before it comes out, I put a picture of it up on Facebook and Twitter, and for that matter, Tumblr, and to let people know, hey, just got this, it'll be on shelves in a week or so. Those are the obvious places to find me. I have a blog. It's at my website, busick.com. The blog doesn't have much on it aside from the online letter columns for Astro City, but I live in hope. But I would say Twitter and possibly Facebook are the easier places to find me
to keep up to date on what's going on with Kurt Busick.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Kurt.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.